If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, September the 17th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. My guest today in our studio here in Hoover's Washington, D.C. office, which is about a block or two away from the White House, is Deborah Saunders. Maybe you know her better by her byline, which is Deborah J. Saunders, to her friends, one of which I think I am. We've known each other for a long time. We call her Deb Saunders. But, Deb, good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Bill.
Deb Saunders is the White House correspondent for the Las Vegas Review-Journal and a Hoover Media Fellow. Prior to coming to Washington, she was a political columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, their in-house token conservative. And in a very weird twist of history, Deborah, if you had not taken that job, you'd be in California right now following Donald Trump, who's on the West Coast.
My life would be hell if I had not left the Chronicle, and I had planned on giving notice the day after the election, and I did. And when I did it, I thought Hillary Clinton would be president. So I had no idea that this was coming. But when I think about what it would be like, because there were times I voted for Gary Johnson. I was very critical of Donald Trump, and I was also, there were times I thought there were things I really liked that he did. Mm-hmm. I thought he did well in the debates, and I got a lot of flack for any time I wrote anything positive about him. So I think about what my life would be like. Now, I got a lot of flack as a conservative columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle for 24 years.
That goes with the job, though.
That goes with the job. But there gets a point where, you know, things can get old. We'll just put it that way. And I can just imagine the hysteria and would have been aimed in my direction for anything I said positive about Trump. So, I happen to agree, by the way, with a lot of his criticism on California too. So, I can just say, I did it for 24 years. I'm not doing it anymore.
I think San Francisco has become worse since you left. It's not just a reflection on you not being there, but the city itself, when you just look at the problems facing it in terms of homelessness, in terms of crime, in terms of just grit and dirt on the street and human products and so forth.
It stinks.
Just the incredible income disparity. I don't know how much on the East Coast you saw of the opening of the new arena out west, but it's kind of like Elizabeth Warren's worst nightmare come to light, was just very wildly rich people cavorting in San Francisco. It's a city that just is a cautionary tale, and that's kind of the sad thing of Trump mocking California. God knows it's a target-rich environment, but there needs to be a serious conversation about how that state is really on the wrong track in a lot of ways, and just mocking it doesn't quite do the job.
And yet, I mean, that is how he won in 2016. I think you're going to see him bashing California a lot. And I think there are a lot of people in this country that look at a city like San Francisco and think, I don't want that. I don't want that for where I live. And so there was Adam Laxalt, the former attorney general of Nevada, who lost the governor's race in 2018, had a Basque fry over the weekend. And he told me ahead of time, he said, we feel like Nevada could become California, and we want to fight the Californianization of Nevada. And I think a lot of people look at California and think, I don't want that. I don't want a bunch of homeless people camping out. I mean, and you know what San Francisco is like. We're talking about blocks of tents.
Yes.
Who would choose that?
Right. Well, this has already become a rallying cry in political elections. Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, is reelected last year, and what is his motto? Don't California my Texas.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's a good issue for Donald Trump.
I guess so, but it does have serious problems you need to be addressing. What happens when the cat's away? Do the mice play in the White House press office?
I'd say, yeah, a little bit. I mean, when Trump is around, you just never know for sure when certain things are going to happen. They give out guidance the night before every day, and they'll tell you, obviously not everything on the president's agenda. They don't. Governors don't do that either.
Right.
But they'll give you some hints, and you'll see, for example, Sometimes there'll be nothing scheduled where Trump is going to be talking to the press. There'll be everything will be closed press, or sometimes it will say nothing on the calendar. And but that doesn't mean that that's really going to be the case. And you don't know if there will if he'll end up inviting the pool in, or and you just don't know what's going to happen.
So this is subject to the change of what happens between when they finish that the night before and the president gets up the next morning and he's seen what's on TV and he's checked his Twitter feed and he's off to the races.
That could happen. Right. And of course, the other thing is, so I'm a member of the in-town pool, and I'll just confess to you, my biggest nightmare is being in the Oval Office when he talks for 90 minutes, because you have to be basically with your phone, putting out pool reports, and taping it, and being ready to give a more comprehensive report later. And I've been there for 25 minutes, that was okay. But I mean, that's to me the most terrifying part of the job.
That's funny. So he'll go, I assume that's impromptu 90 minutes. I don't think they block out 90 minutes for him just to freelance and freeform with the press, right?
That's, well, I mean, we don't really understand what's on his schedule, to tell you the truth. Yeah. But yeah, he can, I mean, he's the president. If he decides he wants to talk for 90 minutes, he can do it. Or for 60 minutes or whatever. So he brings a pool spray in. He's got, you know, the president of Hungary there or something like that. And he just talks. And sometimes it'll be, I mean, it's just, sometimes he'll just talk for 5 minutes, and sometimes he'll talk for a lot longer, and you don't know what he's going to say. And that's a reason why you always want to stay on your toes when he's in town.
March the 11th of 2019. That's the answer to the trivia question. Name the last day that the White House had a traditional press briefing.
Yes.
So three words you don't hear in the White House press room besides "I love you" is "call the briefing."
Yes.
So what happened to the briefing?
Well, so the briefings ended when Sarah Sanders was press secretary. And I think pretty much what happened is that she realized that Donald Trump wanted to be the voice of the administration. And he didn't want briefings. So they had, you know, they didn't just stop one day. They were becoming more rare, and then they did stop one day. Now we have had, so now we have a new press secretary, Stephanie Grisham. Mm-hmm. Stephanie Grisham does not want to become a Saturday Night Live character, and she is not going to feed that beast if she can help it. We have had two briefings in the last month, but she didn't give them. We had the Customs and Border Patrol head, and then we had Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, and Steven Mnuchin, Secretary of Treasury. They gave a briefing. But basically, that's not happening. So what do we have instead? You can't say, my preference would be briefings, because there's a certain kind of order about it, and you can get more clarification. Donald Trump talks to the press a lot, but he doesn't necessarily give you something definitive to go with. And he frequently contradicts himself within like two sentences.
Right.
It makes it difficult. So instead of having a briefing, we have a few things. Like we have Kellyanne goes on Fox News in the morning, and people grab her afterward for what they call a gaggle. And you can watch those on C-SPAN afterward. Mm-hmm. And then we have Trump doing pool sprays in the Oval, or Marine One departures and arrivals. He doesn't talk on arrivals that much, but departures,
right,
which are not conducive to communication in a lot of ways. You can throw out questions with him, and you can get answers for something, you know, really specific. You might say something new, and you'll get some news that way.
There's nothing thoughtful that comes out of those. Those are quick sound bites and just him responding to something.
You can't do follow-ups.
Right.
Now, there are people who don't mind the status quo in the press. I've heard some people on TV say the tyranny of the front two rows. And I'm somebody who, you know.
But that's an electronic versus print thing. I mean, not print, because they're electronic. But I don't know.
No, I'll just say they're my preference. But there are people who actually will get more answers from White House people, because if you're willing to be there and wait all morning,
right,
you can, you know, chances are that Hogan Gidley, who does like to be on TV, unlike Stephanie,
the deputy press secretary.
Or Kellyanne or Larry Kudlow will be out there talking, and you can get something.
So who controls who goes on TV? Stephanie?
I would imagine she does. I don't know the answer to that.
Is she both the press secretary and the communications director right now?
She has four jobs. She is the press secretary.
I counted three of them in the day. Press, communications, and Melania?
Yes, and she's Melania, press secretary, and Melania, director of communications.
So actually, they're saving the tax. So each of those jobs pays about $179,000, I think.
Yeah.
So Saving us $500,000.
That's right.
This seems to be the MO of this White House. It is people go and then don't backfill, and so people start Mike Pompeo. By the time he finishes, he may have two jobs for all we know.
And Mike Mick Mulvaney, who has had many, who knows how that will work.
So she's really running the communication show then.
Sure looks that way. You don't see it.
Yeah.
I mean, she has her office. It's in what they call it upper press.
Right.
There's lower press. So.
But then again, the president. Is the communication show. He is the communicator in chief, truly.
He really thinks that way. And I think that, I mean, one of the problems one has covering the White House is that it's pretty clear that nobody wants to get ahead of Donald Trump. Nobody wants to eclipse him. And so people are, you're not necessarily, it's not the easiest thing in the world to get the information that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you had any one-on-one time with him yet?
I have interviewed him with other regional reporters twice.
Tell me a bit about that experience.
The first time, I got a bunch of great stories out of it, and they said it was off the record, and I couldn't use any of it.
Great.
So I can't tell you what he said, but I can tell you I asked a lot of questions about Steve Wynn, because that was a big story.
Did they tell you going in or coming out that was off the record?
We knew beforehand, but one tries. Okay, so this is a trick, which is they say it's off the record, and then they'll say something, and you say, "Is that on the record?" And they say, yes. Well, so, that was tried and not successful the first time. The second time I was with another group of reporters, and those were the conditions, and we just kept saying, is that on the record? And he'd say, yes. So I said, why did Dean Heller lose? He's the Nevada senator who ran for re-election and lost in 2018. That was all I said, and I got, like, a great story. And then I had my second question was, is that on the record?
Really? He was wired into the Nevada Senate race?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it was shortly, you know, like, I think it was in January, something like that. So yeah, there were a bunch of us, and people were, I don't believe in asking long, complicated questions if I can help it, and that avenue worked well for me that day.
Has there been a time where you've been on the receiving end of the White House wrath?
Sure.
For example?
Yeah, I mean, there are times that there have been things they haven't liked. That's all.
Are you going to travel with them next year?
I would imagine I am. I have done some traveling. I don't do everything. Mm-hmm.
You are a one-woman bureau here, right?
I am the only person covering the White House for the RJ. I have a colleague, Gary Martin, who covers Capitol Hill, who can step in. But it's really time-consuming. I mean, I write on everything. A lot of the people who are traveling are, you know, they're foreign policy people. They really, you know, I just write on everything. So I could be writing on, today it's USMCA. Yesterday it was on Brett Kavanaugh. I could do something on, it's just everything. Whatever it is, I write on it. So, I did go on the first, you know, I've been to Saudi Arabia, Israel, Italy, Brussels, Germany, Poland, and Singapore with the president.
Well, now you get to do Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you know,
Michigan.
I definitely will do some of the rallies with him and see what happens. It's interesting to watch how people react to his rallies.
The rallies are interesting to watch. He did one in New Mexico last night. It looked like quite a show. I guess he had to turn away, rebuild, which is always fascinating. He then goes to California, where it's the opposite dynamic, where they do stuff under the radar. I spent the last week getting calls from reporters, some mutual friends we have, all wanting to know if I knew where the fundraiser was being held, as if I would tell them and thus ruin the life of somebody.
yeah, that's right.
Here's a map. Here's where you need to fly your drone.
Yeah, that's right.
No, but it shows the difference with California. But do we think Trump is a one-off, or do we think that Trump is changing media relations in this regard? The idea that a lot of media is driven through what the president himself tweets and comments every day. You don't need an organ like the White House press secretary. The idea that you don't do something like a theme week, although I assume this White House has tried theme weeks, so I'd imagine they probably fall apart pretty fast. Just the idea of message discipline, the idea to just kind of bounce from situation to situation, and maybe most important and salient to you, Deborah, the idea that a president can benefit from media hostility. I was talking to Charlie Hurt earlier today, the Fox News contributor, Washington Times columnist. He's very pro-Trump. He wrote a book on Trump. And We talked about this for a couple minutes. I worked on the Bush campaign back in 1992, and we lost. And we did what every losing campaign does. We put out bumper stickers saying, annoy the media, vote for Bush. This is the telltale sign, Deb, of a losing campaign when you're blaming the media for your problems. But
until 2016.
Then this guy comes along, and he attacks the media in no uncertain terms. Yes, it's a two-way street in terms of hostility, but he makes the media his punching bag, and he continues to make the media his punching bag, and it seems to work for him.
So I don't think whoever the next president is, whenever that happens, that we will necessarily have daily press briefings again. I think that could be just over. Theme weeks, well, I mean, it's a big joke in the White House because Infrastructure Week, every time they do that, like all these other things would happen that just blew it, right? I think actually the White House does do them, but they don't turn out well. Being anti-media, you know, people hate us. People hate reporters. People hate the White House press corps. People on the left and the right hate us.
And this is a big difference between 2019 and way back in 1992, where there was not the institutional the institution of the media itself was not under siege the way it is today. And there are a lot of reasons for this. I mean, Fox News comes along, the internet, people's attitudes change. But yeah, the media is just a weak institution right now.
Yeah, and I mean, there are, I have to say, I look at some of the coverage about Trump. I look at that New York Times story on Brett Kavanaugh, which was just, I can't believe that made it into that paper. Yeah. It was just so poorly sourced. I mean, it was embarrassing. And so I think that people feel that a number of outlets have an agenda. I think it.
Yeah. What surprised me about the New York Times story was you could look at it very cynically and say they ran this for two reasons. Number one, sell a book. And the story comes out right at the same time the book does. What a surprise. But the other is they just despise this president so much and everything attached to him, such as Brett Kavanaugh, that they are willing to go forward with the story that is, what, all secondhand information and it's not sourced and doesn't pan out. I mean, that's shocking for the New York Times to do this.
It's sad. Yeah. You know, I mean, I look at this and I think, I'm not somebody who hates the New York Times. I love the New York Times. It's so well written. Mm-hmm. There are so many things it does well. And then it makes such a rookie mistake like this, where it's not like they haven't done this before. It's not like they shouldn't. And they knew it was a bad story. I mean, that's the thing, Bill. I saw what they put out about why it was where it was. But when that story, it was on the second, not only in the opinion pages, not the news pages, mm-hmm. but on the second page of the news pages, they knew it was a problem.
Yeah, but in that regard, it's not a rookie mistake.
Yes.
It's actually you know, quite thought through, and they're doing this because they despise this man so much. Let's have a little fun for a minute. Let's play a little alternate history, which I always love to do. And let's talk about an alternate world in which Deborah J. Saunders does come to Washington, but she's here to cover the historic situation that is the first female American president of the United States. Mm-hmm. Fascinates me in this regard. First of all, as we talk about Trump and the media, this weird relationship of how Trump needs the media. Trump would not exist without the media. And the media, to a large extent, needs Donald Trump. If you just look at the ratings for CNN and MSNBC, and you look at the profit margins of the Washington Post and the New York Times, this is not happening if Hillary is the 45th president of the United States. It's a very different town. But also just the way Washington would be covered. I'll give you an alternate universe, Deb, in which Hillary is the president. Bill is whatever title they would have come up with for Bill.
Dude? No, I guess that doesn't work out so well, does it?
Whatever. First problem, probably. Headache.
Yeah.
And we'll take a situation. Here's the one I'll throw in front of you, as you have some thoughts on this, and that's Jeffrey Epstein, the very troubled New York financier who dies in prison under very rather shaky suspect circumstances. And it's all the rage on cable for a couple of days, but doesn't really resonate around Washington. Why? Yeah, Trump has a connection to Epstein. Epstein went to Mar-a-Lago a couple of times, but it was a million years ago. He has very deep connections over to the world of the Clintons. So here's what I throw to you, Deb. In a Hillary Clinton Washington, Republicans would probably still be in control of Congress. They would all have Congress in 2018. The story would have broke, and you'd have House and Senate Republicans in a pell-mell rush to do what? Hold hearings on Epstein. Embarrass Bill Clinton because the story goes back to the same olds of Clinton scandals, which is a combination of sex, greed, ethical lapses, and so forth.
Bad judgment.
That would have been Washington under Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. So let me just say one thing about Jeffrey Epstein, which is the Miami Herald never would have covered his story if it weren't for Donald Trump picking Alex Acosta to be his labor secretary.
Uh-huh.
And this is the thing. This is why people hate the media, because That was it wasn't a story for them that Jeffrey Epstein got off. He did go to he was in jail sort of kind of for about a year, but in their own backyard, this rich guy pedophile moves around it with impunity, and they didn't care and didn't notice until Trump's picks Acosta. And that's when they decided to do a story about what happened with Epstein. None of this would have happened. Jeffrey Epstein would be alive today if Trump had not picked Acosta. And so all of these people who were like, how could this happen? You know, the New York U.S. attorney, nothing prevented them from going after Epstein for all that time since he did time in Florida jail. Nothing stopped anybody in law enforcement outside of that one area. I mean, if he reoffended, people could do things, right? There was no, in the French, I mean, we had a place in Paris. Nobody cared until Acosta was involved. And then it became the big story for the Miami Herald. Shame on them is all I can say, that they never would have noticed if Trump hadn't picked Acosta.
So our Washington Post headline, Saunders blames Trump for Epstein's death. That's
sure.
How it works today, right?
Sure.
But no, it's a very different world if Hillary Clinton is in Washington instead of Donald Trump. And that's what I'm every time I come back here, this is what I try to figure. How much of an impact Trump had on Washington? How much is he changing Washington? Or just how much it reverts to its former self if and when he leaves?
You know, I think the difference is that, in part, that for Trump, being ruthless, it's a model.
Right.
He doesn't pretend to be anything different. His voters love him for it. They think it's. I'll give you an example of something he'll do. I did a tweet this week about how he was asked if he was going to watch. I forget what. Oh, the debate last week, and he said, "No, maybe." You know, and then and of course you know the answer is yes. Of course he's going to end up watching it. You're not quite sure when, but you know he is. And it's just frustrating because how do you write about that? What do you say when you get an answer like that, right? Mm-hmm. And this one of his fans tweets to me, isn't it great? He always keeps people guessing. And I responded to him, what, you want a president who always keeps people guessing? Like on everything? Like why would you? I don't get that. But his supporters, they hate the media and they just love Trump putting his, you know, finger in our eyes. And you know, obviously people in my profession have done something to deserve this. It doesn't come out of nowhere. But he's made this, he doesn't pretend to be something different about it.
Right.
He's so forthright that it works for him. Whereas the Clintons were always trying to pretend that they were, you know, get rid of the travel office people. It's because they're against, you know, corruption. And there were so many things that they did like that, and it just never worked. And, of course, you know, Hillary Clinton just doesn't play with a lot of people.
Yeah, that's well put. Let's talk about two people who are in the White House who don't get as much press coverage as the president, but are also interested to talk about. One is the First Lady. What kind of press relations does she have, if any?
Well, it's often a lot of work to get stuff out of, to find out what the First Lady's doing. They're very protective of her. And, you know.
They don't put out a daily FLOTUS schedule for you?
No.
No, I mean, I'm not saying hour by hour. What is she doing, but just I don't tell you if she's going X, Y, or Z.
If there is one, I never thought of getting on it. I've covered her because I've pulled the First Lady. And, I mean, she's not your typical political wife.
Mm-hmm.
During that escalator ride, she foresaw what was going to happen. Maybe,
right.
I mean, we know, we've heard different things about that, whatever. But, you know, I just give her a lot of room. I just think that she deserves to not be hammered
First ladies,
by people.
First ladies come in and they want a political identity, I should say, tied to a policy. So it's literacy, it's organic gardening, you name it, whatever. Has she tried this, and does she really have one at this point?
Oh, yeah, she does. It's Be Best.
Okay,
it's
Be
her
Best.
Anti-bullying campaign. Now, okay, like, I remember.
Pause for irony, right?
Yeah, well, I remember I was in New York for a United Nations speech that she gave to not in the floor itself, but an event there. And I talked to her folks, and I'm like.
Really?
Yeah.
No bullying.
And what I was told is, yes, this is very important to her. And I actually think that this is her way of talking back to Donald Trump. I do. I think that this is her way of sort of evening that and making her stand known on that. And it's a pretty... Okay. I do. What can I say? Maybe I'm wrong.
Interesting. Let's talk about the other person in the White House who could probably talk back to the president, and that's his daughter, Ivanka. How does she interact with the media?
You know, she's not somebody who... I barely see her because, I mean, they send her on a lot of trips.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure the people who end up covering those trips are people... It's not happenstance, let's just put it that way.
Right. Well, it strikes me as a curious blend, Deb, because on the one hand, she is active mm-hmm. and she's visible, mm-hmm. but she is also not engaged in what we would call in Washington attention-seeking behavior. In other words, I'm going to be at this event. I'm here for reporters. Or they're not setting her up with, you know, you and others for one-on-ones to showcase, you know, the glory that is Ivanka Trump. So she has kind of one foot in both camps, it seems. She is visible in public, but at the same time, also not marketing herself.
Yeah, and I think that there's a certain protection element to that. That she's, again, I don't think she expected to be doing this exactly. In 2015. She's in that position, and I think the people in the White House want to protect her a little bit. I understand that, actually. So,
I see. So are we in the new normal for White House press relations right now?
Are we going to have daily briefings again? No. That's just not going to happen.
Not at least not as long as Stephanie has a job, right?
I don't...
Because the logic is, if I'm not on TV, you can't make me an SNL character.
But Sarah Sanders was... The briefings ended under her, and that was not an issue for her.
Did you watch Sean Spicer last night, by the way?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you missed it?
I missed it.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So let's not talk about it.
See, there's a future after working in this White House.
Yeah, there is.
Interesting. But, yeah, so the briefing. You think the briefing is, as long as Trump is president, there will not be a daily briefing.
He does not want to share the spotlight.
Okay. But, again, the question, does it really matter if you have a daily briefing?
Well, it matters to me. But does it matter to readers? I think the White House would be better off with daily briefings because there would be a more articulated position on a number of issues. Right now, it's Trump will say one thing one day and another thing the other day, and you're not sure which thing he's going to stand by. Look at guns. Whereas I do think if we had briefings, people could ask questions about background checks. I mean, you get answers. You can ask questions. You'll get statements. You will get some answers. But I do think it would be sort of, you'd have more clarifying moments. And that's the thing that's sad. I don't get all indignant about much.
Right.
I've been called every name in the book. There's nothing new.
Yeah.
I'm pretty like even about all that stuff. But, I don't know. I do think that people would be better served if we had better, more clarification on policy. I'm not one of those people who thinks, isn't it great? He's keeping us guessing. So
if you're a young journalist, if you're an aspiring journalist listening to this podcast and you're wondering what it's like to be in the White House press corps, tell me the upside of being in that press corps.
You're in the White House all the time, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And there are days when you're like, you're there. It's an important moment, and you get to see it. I was doing a pool one day. Actually, I got in with the pool when Trump had. It was after the Florida high school shooting, and Trump had a bunch of senators in, Democrats and Republicans, and I was there when he started telling Pat Toomey, "You're afraid of the NRA. I'm not." I mean, that just sticks in my mind. It's just this moment, like. I can stand up to them. And now, of course, I keep thinking back on that moment. So it's just the first briefing that Trump had in the East Room, where it went on for, I believe, over an hour. Like, that was just an amazing event to be there. And just to see that was incredible. The only thing I could think to compare it was with the City Hall briefing that Gavin Newsom gave his mayor after stories came out about his involvement with his former campaign manager's wife, and he walked out and he said, "Everything you've heard, it's all true." And we're like, "Whoa!" So that was the only thing that I could compare it to. So that was the I mean, there are some amazing moments. I think that I think Trump is talking so much now that it is sort of hard to keep track of all the different things he says about stuff. So it was, you know,
well,
that was
there are ways to keep track of what he says. I mean, look, there's PolitiFact, there are all kinds of Trump meters and things like that. But here's the thing that surprises me. How much do people care? Obviously, his detractors care, and they always care about this, but those who support Trump don't. But the people in the middle, do they really, how much are they bothered by him?
I think it's important for people who are lawmakers to know what he's saying.
Yeah.
And I think, for example, on the whole gun issue, and that there are a number of senators who would like to maybe do something, or maybe they don't want to do something, but they want to know what he wants to do, and they're not going to move until they know, because they've seen him. What?
I think McConnell's made it pretty clear. He said, the president tells us what he's willing to sign.
And he won't say it.
Right.
I mean, he still won't say it. So that's sort of, that's, again, whatever your position is on this,
right,
it's a reason to care about what he says. But I think a lot of people tune him off. I mean, what's going to happen in 2020? I don't know. I thought he would not win in 2016, so I'm not going to bet the mortgage on him, on anything. But I think one of the things that will really make a difference is, do people start turning him off? Are there people who just think, I've heard this guy enough? I remember when Barack Obama was first president, Bill Maher made a joke. He said, I don't want to see my president more than a Law and Order reruns. He was criticizing Obama for being out there too much. And look at this guy. I mean, there are days when he just tweets and he doesn't talk to the press. But there are days when he talks to the press two or three times. Oh, here's another great one. Yesterday, he said, I'm working on something, I'm in our bureau, and he says, I'm going to give a press briefing, and it's like 3:30, and he's leaving at 4:10, and he didn't mean it. He meant he's going to give a gaggle, and he cut the gaggle short so he could leave. I mean, it's just, I know most people don't care, but you can maybe understand why I would.
Well, it's an interesting thought, because he's not the same novelty he was in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he is still novel in that nobody else does this act, and I don't think anybody else can do this act. So when you see him, like last night where he was in New Mexico, it's still a show to watch.
Yeah.
And I can say it's familiar. We've been hearing a lot about this for 4 years, but it's still, you know, it's very compelling TV. I guess the question, this is, you're getting to it, Fox News, for example. Fox News would just run these things forever, you know, hour and a half or however. They're now cutting back on them.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they're making a decision, and part of it's eyeballs, and they'll show the whole thing if they get enough people writing in and angry. Interesting, by the way, that Trump has actually started tweeting against Fox.
Yeah, well, he's definitely not happy with Fox. I was there for his 2-hour speech at CPAC, and I thought, that was, you just, I really do feel in a way that Fox cutting him off could maybe discipline his length time, because presidents don't tend to become more terse over time.
Right.
They tend to talk longer.
Yeah, and this guy, you know, without the restraint of having to face re-election.
Yeah.
Watch out. But you watch these rallies, though, and it just is a show in this, not just the crowd going crazy, but he stands up there and just, there's a lot of nuance to what he does. It's not just giving the lines. It's also him taking breaks in between and just looking at the audience and just, it's showmanship, plain and simple, the likes of which you see from very few politicians.
Oh, he just knows how to mug like nobody's business. He's
and I'm not saying
really
I'm a fan of this necessarily, but it's just worth knowing. This is something very unique to look at.
He does it well. I mean, yes. he does it well. He does it really well. I mean, you watch him, you know what he's thinking. Mm-hmm. He has that look on his face, and he knows how to mug.
Did you read the Atlantic article suggesting that politics is becoming a family business for the Trumps?
I just don't.
I'd point out the headline and the article didn't quite match up. The article explained what all the Trumps are doing. The headline made it look like they're the Kennedys.
Yeah, and the truth is, Ivanka Trump is never going to get elected to anything, you know, or at least not, I don't know, not New York.
She'd have to move somewhere she doesn't want to live. That's
yeah,
the problem.
That's right. So, I mean, I just took one look at that and I thought, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes they play off people's fears.
Yeah.
And
what about Junior?
Yeah, I think he could go into politics. I don't know how well he'll do.
Well, we have the fascinating bad TV series of him dating Gavin Newsom's ex-wife now, which really is like TV come to life, when you think about it.
It really is. They could make a, they could do a,
yeah. I mean, in that regard, it's a shame Newsom's not running against him in 2020. And it would just, this would just be such a juicy, juicy campaign.
Well, you know, I've always thought that Newsom could jump in 2020 at some point in time, but that time is running out. So nobody else is really lighting anyone's fire. And isn't it amazing, Bill, that with so much at stake, so many Democrats I know are completely demoralized and don't really think any of these candidates necessarily has what it takes to win?
Well, Republicans were in this boat in 2015 when you started watching the Republican debates and you saw Donald Trump really dominating the proceedings, not just on the stage, but also the coverage thereafter. And you thought, my goodness, if this doesn't stop, Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee and we're going to get wiped out next year.
Mm-hmm.
So Republicans were guilty of this doom and gloom, too. Maybe Democrats find a candidate who connects. But I think the challenge in looking at the Democratic field, Deb, is, and again, I know this from having lived through that Bush campaign, we at all times underestimated Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. We didn't understand how the American landscape had shifted, and we wanted to write him off as just this huckster, this sort of obvious Southern huckster.
Mm-hmm.
And what we didn't respect enough was that Bill Clinton, say what you will about the man's various failings, he is a brilliant political mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy knows how to connect with voters, and he understood the political landscape very clearly, and he found the right issues to run on, and he did it. The challenge I'd put forward to anybody watching that debate is show me the one of those 10 Democrats on the stage who really has his finger or her finger on the pulse of what voters want. And what I'm suggesting is not just understanding issues that Democrats want to hear, but it's also willing to steal a few Republican issues, because that's what Clinton did in 1992.
He took
welfare reform and middle-class tax cuts and capital punishment and rolled them into one, you know, feel-good moderate package for you. So I'm not sure if any of those 10 Democrats are to be feared by Trump right now. I think the interesting question is Donald Trump watching this show and at all times wanting to engage in psych ops with his opponent, because, you know, it's not just competition, it's psychological. He doesn't want to just beat you, he wants to just absolutely derange you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what he relishes most, the idea, not just that I trounced Jeb Bush, but I still live in Jeb Bush's head and Hillary's. I live there rent-free.
So to oppose Trump, you turn into Trump.
Right.
That's what happens. He turns you into him.
But I just wonder which of those candidates he looks at on the stage and thinks, I really want to run against that person because I really am going to enjoy messing with them. I think I know who. But
who?
I think it's Warren.
Yeah, I think
it's her, and I think it's just running against Harvard and just sort of, you know, East Coast intellectualism and
woman.
Well,
running against a woman.
Yeah, because I mean, Joe Biden's an easy guy to parody on a lot of fronts, and gosh knows the problems he's having with history and a lot of things are, you know, rather funny to look at. Joe Biden's not a bad guy at the end of the day, and he's actually had some very bad things happen to him as well. Roughing him up is not the same as actually poking fun at Elizabeth Warren. So I think Warren is probably the person he would relish. Now, this has problems for Trump. I mean, beating up on a woman is a very tricky thing to do on a stage.
He did it to Hillary Clinton.
But she's not quite Hillary, is she?
That's right. No, I absolutely agree. But I think, if you look at a lot of the people he targets, a lot of them are female. I mean, the squad.
Yes.
Pelosi versus Schumer. I think he likes it.
Why?
I don't know. I'm not a shrink, okay?
Yeah.
I think people like the way he will, maybe the word is take down a notch,
mm-hmm.
Certain women. I think people like that.
How many people sit in that little tiny room when there's a briefing?
Well, there are 49 chairs.
Seven rows of seven?
Seven of seven.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are a number of people who are standing as well.
Yeah.
So let's say, I mean, in the beginning, it was so crazy in the beginning.
So like bring them, because the one thing, White Houses can obviously decide who goes in the room, and so you're going to fill that room with a lot of friendly bloggers and things like that.
They can't decide who goes in the room.
No, they don't?
No. The White House Correspondents Association has a lot to do with
that. Oh, so the White House can bring in its own five favorite bloggers if it wants to?
Well, they could. I mean, they could give them a day pass. I mean, there are things that they could do.
Okay.
In the beginning, they didn't have to because, of course, there were a number of very, a number of very pro-Trump media groups that had passes and they got in.
Okay, so it's 49 sitting and then standing room.
And in the beginning, it was just crazy because everybody wanted to be at those briefings. And it was insanity to be there. And now, so there was, when we had Pompeo and Mnuchin, I'd say there were maybe 60, 70 people in the room. It's not a lot, you know. Something like that, yeah. So it's not, there's a lot of competition for space in there.
Right.
There's a lot of competition for space covering the White House all the time.
Mm-hmm. So the 49 people sitting in those seven rows of seven, do you think there are enough people in those seven rows to put into a car in Virginia and drive in the HOV line? Which I think is HOV 2 or 3 the last time I looked. How many people sitting in the seven rows of seven do you think are Trumpers?
Are pro-Trump people.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Not asking to out anybody, okay. But just, you know, we talk about media bias all the time. We talk about, you know, this institution. But in that White House, do you think there are five people there who might have voted for Trump or would vote for Trump?
Yeah, I think there are five people there who voted for Trump. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe 10%.
That high?
Yeah.
Wow.
But they're not in the front two rows.
No.
So, I mean, people don't.
So that front row is pretty much all blue.
Yeah, I would think so. I actually can think of at least one person who may have voted for Trump in the front two rows.
Why does journalism attract liberals?
Well, because they make it really hard for you if you're not a liberal. And I can tell you that story pretty well. I've written a number of pieces about this. So when I worked at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'd ask people, why is it liberals? And they'd say, well, that's because we're so smart. And I'm like, oh yeah, we're so smart, we're journalists. we're in this thriving industry, right? And some would say, well, you know, it's because social justice and this or that. And I think those are elements of it. But the other thing is that if you are a conservative reporter, and I was a columnist, not a reporter then. I'm a reporter now. I also have a column. They drive you out. They don't want different thoughts. And that's sort of the problem the New York Times has. They have some very fair people. But it's pretty clear that some people who are reporters there have incredibly left-wing politics, and they've paid absolutely no penalty for it. And I'm trying to think of anybody who's been a reporter for the New York Times who clearly had conservative opinions. It's not coming to me, Bill. How are you doing on that one? Right.
But you're just saying, anecdotally talking to them, that it would be clear they're conservative, or it would be reflected through their writing?
Both. I mean, y'all hear people say things. I mean, it's a frustrating thing to cover this White House. But there are things that you can say that have to do with lack of transparency and not getting information. And there are things that you can just offer about your view about his politics. And, I think most people there don't agree with his politics.
So I was a journalism major in college, mm-hmm. Dirty Dark Secret, mm-hmm. and I was the editor of my school newspaper. And what I noticed about this from an early start was journalism attracted people who obviously love to write and love to observe and love to analyze, but it also drew in various elements people who were a little resentful, shall I say, especially toward people who had more than they did, money, for example,
mm-hmm.
Especially in my college where you'd have to put the school paper to bed on Wednesday night, which was a party night, and so you'd be putting mm-hmm. the school paper to bed while you can hear parties going on down the road. That kind of makes an attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And then also this idea of, yeah, I'm changing the world through what I'm writing about, which is kind of funny because a lot of times in journalism, you're not doing that.
No.
You know. So yeah, there's sort of a certain sanctimony attached to it. And I think that's something that Trump very smartly does. He kind of attacks the sanctimony. But what shocks me is just how journalists play along with it. They take the bait every time.
Well, it's in their interest, too.
Right.
So I've written about Brian Karam and Trump, right? Brian's done well challenging Trump with those questions. And Trump has been well fighting back with Brian Karam. I mean, by the way, I mean, this is just so interesting.
Brian Karam
is Playboy correspondent for the White House. And
which surprised me. I didn't realize Playboy was still around since Hugh Hefner died, but I guess it still is.
I guess it still is. So anyway, but the thing is that Brian, Brian had his, they tried to revoke his hard pass for suspended for 30 days.
That's when he got into the scuffle with Sebastian Gorka. Right?
That's right.
Yes.
But the thing is that Trump still called on him. All that time afterward, Brian has a great voice, which is something I wish, I'm not great. I don't have that voice that really projects.
Right.
And Brian just does, and he really knows how to belt out a question. And Trump goes, he just keeps going to Brian and going to Brian. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jim Acosta too. Their reputation and April Ryan, their reputations were enhanced by their fights with the White House.
Yes.
Well,
Acosta did a book, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, they were enhanced by it.
Right. She'll have one too. I saw she was in the news. She had a security detail. I was surprised she had a security detail, but apparently she feels she needs a security detail. Don't want a security people going to scuffle with someone. So this is, again, the different world that you have without Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there wouldn't be nearly as many people covering the White House if it were Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump, I can tell you in the early days, a number of us talked about, you know, that basically Trump, you know, he made editors decide to have White House correspondents who may not have had them before. So he's been good for making, you know, for creating the very people he can then turn around and call fake news.
Right. So for all the turnover in the White House, is it a bit turnover in the White House press corps?
You know, I thought there would be a lot more because I would say the White House press corps has had less turnover than the White House, which has had tremendous turnover. I mean, it's like epic record-breaking turnover in the White House.
Yes.
And I think it's because it's a prestige position. I mean, you're covering the White House. And a number of the people who were there, they were covering the White House before. Mm-hmm. And so they have they have continuity. And there's been some turnover. But I was, you know, sometimes I look at the photos you see in the very beginning. A lot of those people are still covering the White House.
That is true. He's news.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting angle of 2020, which people don't talk about enough. Whoever wins a Democratic nomination, they're going to be in competition with Trump for votes, but also in competition with Trump just to be in the news on a daily basis. And that's a hard guy to compete with for the soundbite of the day.
That's right. And yeah. I think most of those candidates are not up to it.
Yeah. I mean, just ask yourself as a reporter, would you rather follow Trump around for a day or Joe Biden?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is Trump, because you just don't know what you're going to get for better or for worse. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's just there's more of a chance for news.
That's right.
Which gets into kind of a selfish thing, which is if Deb Saunders wants to be on the front page of her newspaper, better chance of it happening with Trump instead of the Democratic nominee.
That's correct.
Yeah. So what is the new normal? Are we going to return to the old normal, do you think, in Washington? Or is Trump just, has he salted the earth?
I don't know. I really don't.
I ask you on these shows.
I know. It's like, I'm not sure. I mean, I think he's changed things, but...
Yeah.
You don't know.
No, but it's,
I don't think we'll have daily briefings again.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's any thought. Take us to January 21st of 2021, and mm-hmm. President Biden or President Warren or President Sanders,
mm-hmm.
yikes,
mm-hmm.
and their press secretary says, it's a new day here,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to do X, Y, and Z differently. So let me put it to you this way. If they were to say we're going to do X, Y, and Z differently, what should they do differently? What would be your recommendation? Besides obviously calling you at every briefing.
Thank you. I think they should consider really moving the whole operation. I know that people were crazy.
Moving it, you mean taking it over to the old executive office building?
That's right. Take it.
Which was, for those of you who follow your presidential history, was one of the first mistakes that Bill Clinton made upon being elected president. The Clinton situation was fascinating, Deb, in that he comes in 1993. He's 46 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he is just set up for success because the White House press corps has its first peer.
Mm-hmm.
Someone they can relate to on a lot of levels.
Yes, yes.
Just in terms of issues, age, just generationally, and it should be a natural match. And the first thing they do is they consider relocating the press office over to the old executive office building, and the press corps goes nuts when they hear this.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand, it's very simple. Hillary didn't want them in the same building with her. She wanted them out of the way. And that's a bad way to start off your relations.
It's not like you can walk around all over the place there. I mean, they have Secret Service people there. You can go into the press office. Right. You can't really go beyond that. It's not a good idea.
Exactly. And then the other Clinton mistake, and this ties into Trump as well, was he went to that year's radio and correspondence black tie dinner, and he got up and he cracked what he thought was a very funny joke, which was, guess what, I went on Larry King, you know what I discovered? I don't need you. That's exactly the wrong joke to tell to any reporter. I don't need you. But this is kind of an interesting way to look at the first term of the Trump presidency. Does he need the White House press corps?
I think he loves the White House Press Corps. I think he wants the White House Press Corps to be there. So whether or not he needs the White House Press Corps, what would he do without the White House Press Corps?
He'd find somebody new to pick on.
Well, but it's so handy. You just say, bring in the pool spray, you know? It's so easy. No, he loves the White House Press Corps. He is not going to do anything. I mean, they've made moves that they're going to try to get rid of people who do certain things, like Brian Cameron and Jim Acosta, but they want that. Well, you know that more than anyone, Bill. They like to call on people who give them.
Take away their passes, and the court reinstates the passes. Yeah. Not too long after that goes, they just live for the joust, which is all they do.
Yeah, that's right. And so the White House Press Corps, Trump loves them. He does not want to get rid of them.
Well, that's the odd thing about the situation. Trump needs them, and I think on some levels that the White House Press Corps doesn't want to appreciate, they need him too. And again, getting back to the idea of the Hillary presidency or the Joe Biden presidency to come, it's going to be a lot different and probably a lot more boring.
Yeah, it will. Yeah, probably. We'll see what happens, though. Could easily be Trump, too.
Okay, well, anytime you want to come back to California, you know the invite's there.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. We were talking about this before we started this podcast. You know, he goes to New Mexico and he does a, you know, rally that's live on TV. And then he goes to Northern California to raise money. And I can't tell you how many reporters, mutual friends of ours, have called me the past week saying, you know, do you know anything about the event? You know, can you tell me where it is?
Yeah, that's right. Well, after Deborah Messing said that she wanted information about who the donors would be, I think that the fact that an actress wants to out you and basically plaster your name all over social media if you give him any money made it pretty inevitable that the Trump campaign was not going to give out any information ahead of time. It didn't have to.
I would not want my address released because I'm inviting picketers on my street. We're in an age of drones now, as we've seen with the events of the Middle East. So some idiot's going to fly a drone over my house and put it on the internet. It's just an invitation for bad things to happen.
You could lose your job.
That too. Although I assume the people holding this fundraiser, they probably are
self-employed.
Pretty well off. Yeah. That gets to another conversation about if you had that kind of money, would you actually give it to politics or not? But
look at the Mozilla guy. I mean, you know, he gave it to a campaign and you know who I'm talking about. And he lost his job. So
exactly.
It can happen to anyone.
You give the money to a school for struggling journalists. Mm-hmm. Journalists, old folks home. How's that? Deb Saunders, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Okay. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast that examines the policy avenues and more available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word and get your friends to have a listen. I also recommend you sign up for Hoover's monthly Pod Blast, which gives you the best work of Area 45, Econ Talk, The Classis Strategica, The Pacific Century, Education Exchange. We have a lot of podcasts going at Hoover. Plus fellows' remarks from Hoover events, some of which I do. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover fellows to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Deborah J. Saunders is on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is, not surprisingly, @DeborahJSaunders. The spelling is tricky, though. It's @DeborahJSaunders, DeborahJSaunders. Tricky. The Las Vegas Review-Journal, the fine newspaper she writes for, that's online too, www.reviewjournal.com. Anything else of yours I need to plug?
@reviewjournal.com for Twitter.
Okay, there we go. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care, and thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.